Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, and it's a title once given to me by an NPR producer, but I'll live with it. It sounds a little egotistical, and then I always say the intelligence comes from my guests, and that's almost always the case. In this case, my guest is Ray McGovern, and I don't often go back to people. I should. I've gone back to you a few times now because of Russia controversy, the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, all of these issues. But I want to explain, and I want to get in a little bit. This is actually, today is the 78th anniversary of our dropping the bomb on Nagasaki, and then Hiroshima, of course, was 2 days previous. I do want to talk about a lot of serious things, but I want to really start with objectivity. And Ray McGovern has now joined me. I've known him a long time, and as being controversial. And in fact, he's actually attacked for being more of a Putin apologist, or I don't know if that makes you left or right, since Putin is the guy the U.S. backed against Gorbachev, and he was Yeltsin's protege, and he was supposed to be a good conservative, but I guess a conservative in Russia ends up being a nationalist, and you don't like that. But nonetheless, somehow, Ray McGovern, who I first encountered his work and everything when he was working for the CIA, our trajectory has actually been very different. And one of my arguments is, you know, yes, objectivity is important, certainly for journalists, certainly for people who want to represent the public interest. It's not easy to obtain. And nowadays, we use these slogans of disinformation and fake news as a way of disparaging anybody that disagrees with the government, or the current government, or the Trump government. You are allowed to disagree. And, so it's very difficult. But I want to stress that people bring their own perspective. Lawrence Ferlinghetti once said, keep your listening, your ears open, but not keep an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. And what he meant is we all have a core of experience and belief, philosophy, religion, whatever. And I like talking to you, Ray, because we actually come from, in the context of the Bronx, where we both grew up, and you're a much younger guy. I'm 87. I'm an old coot. You're a young guy of 84. But when I look at our lives there, you went to Fordham University. That was about, I don't know, I guess a mile from where I grew up in the Bronx. I went to City College, very different. And in fact, some of your listeners on your website, what's your website called, Ray McGovern?
RayMcGovern.com.
RayMcGovern.com. Really took umbrage because they said I was anti-Catholic because I made some remarks about Fordham. And it is true. My mother was Jewish. I was very sensitive. And there were, at that time, some people, Catholic, who thought we had something to do with Jews being responsible for killing their Lord or something. And there was tension, ethnic tension and religious tension. And then my father was a German Protestant, so I said only half of me was responsible. And, you know, you get this insane hostility, which you grew up with also, religious, ethnic, and everything else. And we all are affected by it. And my only point was, actually, when you were going to Fordham and you graduated, I believe, at the time in a missile crisis, you were Phi Beta Kappa, one of them really smart guys, and graduated in 61, was it?
Kennedy's That's right.
President. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you got a master's degree in Russian studies in 62. And I want to point this out to people. And then you went into the military. And you were there, and then they let you out early so you could go work for the CIA.
Correct.
Okay, and so you really went into the national security establishment, the very thing that Eisenhower had just warned us about, right? Eisenhower, in his farewell address while you were still in college, warned us about the military-industrial complex, but you joined it, right? you joined it. And it's funny because these days you're now people are questioning your patriotism and so forth. I, on the other hand, was this kind of anti-war character over at City College and had lots of doubts about this. I thought, Eisenhower was great when he called out the military-industrial complex and that it should be looked at upon critically and examined. You were the other way. So why don't we begin with that? Because you, there are people who try to dismiss you now, try to marginalize you. Oh, Ray, he's old, or Ray, you know, what does he know? Well, you know a great deal. You advised how many presidents on
personally? Well, I worked under seven. I wrote the President's Daily Brief for three of them.
Which three?
Nixon, Ford, and Reagan.
So these are three presidents that you actually were responsible for the daily briefing of those three presidents on, you know, on the most serious matters, right?
That's correct. I was one of about five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you were there at the center of power. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And they trusted you. You had all the clearances. You're right.
They trusted me enough to allow me to do that in person, one-on-one, for the first Reagan term, 81 to 85. I was sort of a special gift because my superiors, Bobby Gates in the first instance, and then Bill Casey, put it simply, they saw a Soviet under every rock.
This was at the CIA.
Yeah. They were my bosses, nominally at least. And, they go down to Nicaragua, and Casey would say, "Bobby, you see that Soviet on that rock?" He'd say, "Mr. Casey, there are three of them. Can you see three of them?" Casey said, "You will run my analysis." And he did. Okay. So that's the kind of people that were advising Reagan at the very top. My approach was to Reagan's chief advisors, H.W. Bush, Secretary Shultz, Secretary Weinberger, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Jack Vesey, and then a slew of national security advisors, some of whom ended up in prison. But I briefed them with a teammate every other day, early in the morning. Generally speaking, Reagan himself preferred to sleep in. And so he was briefed by these same characters that we briefed at about 11:30 when he was fully awake.
So I just want to remind people, because right now, American establishment, military influence, if you watch CNN, I just watched your recommendation, a program today where very gloomy about what was happening with the counteroffensive in the Ukraine. There were people from the military industrial complex who now are retired, and so they act like journalists and telling Anderson that, but it might get better or it should get better and so forth. But there's a feeling we have the good war. You know, here are the heroic Ukrainians fighting against the evil Russians. And I just want to remind people that during the Cold War, we always thought we had the good war. And Vietnam is a very good example. Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy, actually is the person most responsible for getting it going. And that's where I got in trouble with your readers who thought I was being anti-Catholic, the American Catholic Church, not the Pope. Pope John actually was raising some fundamental questions with his Pacem in Terris about the waging of war and the need for peace. But there was no question about the virtue of our Vietnamese, even though Diem, who was in charge of South Vietnam, had come out of a Marino seminary in the United States and had been picked by the American military establishment. But with the whole narrative was obviously, we weren't even fighting Vietnam. We were fighting the communists, and they were mostly led by Mao and the Chinese and everything. And everybody forgets that war, which where we were supposed to be on the side of virtue, and you had Tom Dooley, a Navy lieutenant, doctor, who wrote a book about the necessity of fighting for these people, very popular, that the mood was really very supportive of the Diem administration until the U.S. Basically killed Diem. They hunted him down, and he died in a sewer in Saigon trying to hide or whatever. It's all quite mysterious. And so why don't you take us back? Because at that time, you were on the war-making side, right?
Well, Robert, I wouldn't put it that way, actually. Let me go back to where you started, our common heritage in the Bronx. I, too, was from an immigrant family. Mine was Irish. We were pretty secluded, parochial, if you will, provincial, if you will. I had a first-rate education, but it was not the kind of broad exposure to the world that you had at City College. Among other things, I remember that in 1948, the Jews finally got their own country, and there was great rejoicing throughout the Bronx and everywhere else in New York, but nobody told me that there were already people there called the Palestinians, and I had to learn later what that was all about, okay? So it was a little provincial. When you come to serving your country, you mentioned John Kennedy. Well, he made that inaugural speech when I was a senior at Fordham. And you know what he said, ask not what your country can do for you, what you might be able to do for your country. Now, believe it or not, Robert, you could believe this, maybe others can't, but that didn't sound corny at the time. That sounded real. And there was a real threat from Russia. I mean, they did have missiles. They were challenging us in Germany and Berlin, and finally in Cuba. So when I took a political science course at Fordham in my senior year, it was a graduate course, and I talked about this new national security apparatus that had been put together after the war by the National Security Act, 1947, and it included the CIA. What was the CIA all about? It was about telling the president the truth. What was going on in the world with what Truman called untainted, like not biased information as he would get from the State Department or from the Defense Department. Tell me like it is. Now, I was a Russian specialist. That's why they let me out of the army earlier. The CIA paid off the army, and I was able to do my last 1.5 years of active duty at the CIA. That was okay. It was the same government. There was a real Russian threat there. And I had the privilege of being able to tell our policymakers that, for example, the rift, the conflict between Russia and China was extremely real, okay? Don't listen to all those troglodytes that say, they're both commies, for God's sake, don't trust them. It was real. What did that mean? That meant when I became chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch, we were able to tell Nixon and Kissinger, look, they hate each other. You can exploit that. There are 40 divisions, Soviet divisions on the Chinese border, for God's sake. Chinese really have a nicer relationship with you guys. What do you think? Well, they went off to Beijing. You know the rest of the story. Now, I had a particular interest
For people listening to this who don't know the rest of the story, because after all, we don't teach much of this. We should remember the whole justification for the Cold War and certainly for Vietnam was that there was a monolithic communism that was supranationalist because they read Marx or Lenin and they would never care about being Chinese or Russian or Vietnamese. And therefore, they would act in sync and betray the interests of their own people for some kind of pseudo-religion called communism. And it turned out to be utter nonsense. And there were some smart people who knew it at the time. But the policy still was constructed by people who pretended that was real. And then much to the amazement of the American people, even though we were fighting, because nobody could defend going to war in Vietnam with all of, dropping more bombs than had been dropped on Germany during World War II on this tiny area of Vietnam and this people that didn't even have an air force. The old argument was, no, we're stopping the Chinese communists. We're stopping the Russian communists. And then, amazingly enough, this cold warrior, Richard Nixon, who made a career out of, oh, yeah, there's a communist under any bed. And by the way, one of the people who went after Oppenheimer, and there's this popular movie now, Oppenheimer and the Making of the Bomb, this suddenly Nixon is over there with Mao Zedong. Everybody says now you can't talk to Putin. Putin's a monster. Putin's another Hitler. My God, Putin is enlightened compared to Mao in the view of America. First of all, he's not a communist. He's actually broken very severely with communism. But here was Nixon went with Mao Zedong, the guy who was described as the bloodiest dictator maybe in the history of the world by some people in the CIA and the Defense Department. Certainly that was the conventional wisdom. Suddenly, Nixon and Kissinger are over there, just as Kissinger was quite recently. And they say, hey, you know, maybe they were basing it in part on McGovern, but I want to say, to be fair, Richard Nixon wrote an article in Foreign Affairs magazine before he was president, saying there was room to negotiate with China. And there was actually a movement in that direction. But nonetheless, this incredible thing. Now, if an American president, like even Donald Trump, said you might want to talk to Putin and cut a deal, everybody say, no, you're a traitor, right? And there was Nixon. When? You were in the middle of that. You knew about that.
I was. And when Kissinger came to us, my Soviet foreign policy branch, and said, we're going to have these negotiations for limiting strategic arms. You think the Russians are really interested in doing that? Well, I named three people from my branch to go with the delegation in Helsinki or Vienna, and then one down in the bowels of the CIA to report on what the military developments were. And we reported back. We said, yeah, the Russians are really interested. And they said, why? Well, number one, they don't want to spend themselves into oblivion. But number two, they're afraid of the Chinese. There's this triangular relationship now, and they don't want the Chinese to steal a march on them and develop good relations with you. Well, Kissinger went to Beijing in 1971. Nixon goes in early 1972. And all of a sudden, we see a lot of leeway, a lot of flexibility in the Soviet negotiation position on limiting offensive and defensive missilery and nuclear arms. So, long story short, I got to go to Moscow in May of 1972 for the signing of this incredible treaty. That was the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Now, just to spell out very briefly, it was really simple. We were building SCADs of offensive missiles and defensive missiles. There was no end to the competition. Finally, these people said, well, hey, look, let's create kind of a balance of terror. If there are no anti-ballistic missiles, neither side can think that they could make a first strike on the other without suffering immediate and devastating response, okay? That's what they did. That was the ABM treaty was all about. Limiting the number of ABM sites you could have in a country, first to two and then to one. And so they went ahead and now Kissinger says to me, are the Russians going to cheat? I said, I don't know. Well, how soon could you tell me? So I went back to the people that run all the satellites and all that other stuff. You know, you can do that when you're in a position of some importance. So you say, how long? I said, 7-10 days. Go back. 7 to 10 days, sir. All right. I think we'll go ahead on that basis. Doverai no proverai. Trust, but verify. Did the Russians cheat? Yes, they cheated. Did we find out? Yeah, within 7 days? Yes. Where was it? On Siberia, a place called Krasnoyarsk. God awful place. But they built this incredible radar that could only be for ABM usage. And Reagan called them on it. That's the way we used to do things in those days, right? He'd say, show them the pictures. We showed them the pictures. These guys, no, 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 it's not an IBM site. So finally, Gorbachev comes in. Reagan is gone. G.W. Bush is in place. And he says, all right, there. It's an IBM site. We'll tear it down. And he does. I'm just saying here that it's possible to talk to people. It's possible to trust and verify. And when you get around the table, it's often possible to work out deals that never would have been seen as possible. Before you sat down at the table. And that's what's missing today, of course. There's no trust. There's no trust. You don't have to verify anything. There's just no trust. And that's a really dangerous situation. You mentioned Oppenheimer. We can talk about that later, but we're closer
to...
Talk
about it now. Go ahead.
I saw it yesterday. I'm not a real big moviegoer, but I was terribly disappointed. For God's sake, you know? Here's this really bright, youngish, white male, just tortured, just brilliant. All right, I sympathize with that.
You're talking about Oppenheimer now.
Yeah, Oppenheimer. He's the victim of it. So, what about those tens of thousands of Japanese? There was only one key moment in that film that was not brought out in any real detail.
Let me just point out those tens of thousands of Japanese. I mean, the figures, I think they go much higher,
They do hundreds of thousands, yeah.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, and I'm quite positive about the movie, so we could have a lively discussion. I think it's a classic, I do, but we could disagree about that. But the fact of the matter is, we're having this discussion on the United States government, which is supposed to be the center of civilization, we're the only ones who have ever used these weapons. We not only created them, but we didn't just set it off in the ocean and kill some fish or a lot of fish. There were a lot of things. Eisenhower didn't feel the need to drop the bomb. He's expressed that. The movie does go into some of the tension, but there were plenty of people who said you should not use it. And the war was in effect over. The movie's pretty light on that. Really, all the Japanese wanted was some language saying they can have an emperor. There really wasn't much of a sticking point. Another reason was they didn't want the Russians to come in, and the Russians were supposed to come in, I believe it was 90 days after some period of time after the defeat of the Germans, and they would have been, part of the occupying force, so there was a need for that. But I think the point of the movie is the power of these weapons, and of course they're far more dangerous now, and I want to get into that because we're almost giddy or oblivious to the fact that we're on the cusp of nuclear war now. I want to get to that, and that's why I think the movie is very powerful. But I want to ask you a question. There's a character in the movie, Edward Teller. And it's not the way I remember Edward Teller. I interviewed Edward Teller. I had quite a bit of contact with him. Edward, the father of the H-bomb, he's the guy there. He looks sinister. And then during the test, he's got some kind of grease to protect him on his face and his glasses and so forth. But everybody forgets. And here, I'm actually resting my computer on a book to make it go higher that I wrote called With Enough Shovels. You probably remember this. Reagan, Bush, a nuclear war, dig a hole, cover it with a couple of doors, and then throw 3 feet of dirt on top. It's the dirt that does it. If there are enough shovels to go around, everybody's going to make it. That was from T.K. Jones, Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Strategic and Theater Nuclear Forces. Well, we are even in a worse place now, because at that time, there was active discussion, and other people mentioned the book. I remember I interviewed Hans Bethe, who was in charge of theoretical research at Los Alamos in the making of the bomb. A lot of those people spoke out and said, this is madness. Star Wars is madness. You can't fight a new. You're not hearing that now. And in fact, you wrote a column recently talking about, the possibility, both the Russians using it, if they're into a corner, are using it. So something that we had come during the worst days of the Cold War to see his absolute madness, we now think, well, maybe you can do it, right? Where are we on this issue now? And I think Reagan should be remembered positively as the person who accepted Gorbachev, despite Reagan's rhetoric about those monsters. I know I interviewed him at some length. But the fact of the matter is, he and Gorbachev both agreed these weapons could not be used and we should get rid of them, at least make big advances in getting rid of them. That's now, if you said that now, that would be heresy. So let's talk a little bit about the nuclear dimension, Nagasaki, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reagan, of course, did conclude the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which destroyed, now I emphasize, destroyed a whole class of medium range and intermediate range nuclear missiles and warheads stationed already deployed in Europe, okay, on both sides. The Russian side, it was SS-20s. The U.S. side, it was Pershing 2s. Destroyed. Scott Ritter, my good friend, was one of those people who went up and inspected one of those places, made sure that doverai no proverai, that we could monitor, that we could prove that these things were being destroyed. So you're right about Reagan. Just getting back to Oppenheimer for a second. Bob, I tend to think in two terms here. I think I mentioned this little vignette where President Truman and Jimmy Burns were together there and they invited Oppenheimer in.
He's the Secretary of State.
Yeah. Now, where was he from? He is from the great state of Georgia. And what did he share with Harry Truman? Bias, prejudice to the core. Truman himself very seldom referred to African Americans with anything other than the N-word, okay? People who don't look like us are much easier to kill. Japanese, yellow peril, what the Japanese had done to us in Pearl Harbor and all that kind of stuff, it made it easy for Truman and Burns alone, against the advice of Eisenhower, against the advice of MacArthur, against the advice of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, although there was no Joint Chiefs, Halsey, all these top military people said, look, it's not needed. And as you, Bob, have already pointed out, the Japanese, we knew from intercepting their messages, their coded messages, and translating them, that they would give up as soon as we said, all right, you can keep your damn emperor. We won't string him up. You can keep, he won't have any power, but you can keep. They would have quit on the spot. Now, why the hell did we do that? Well, number one, we had this bomb, right? Number two, we could use it against people that don't look like us, all right? And number three, there's this anti-communism that had already really been very firmly implanted. Instead of saying to the Russians, hey, we're about to jointly conquer Japan. Let's do a deal. Let's talk about this. We think that you're entitled to something for what you've done. Now let's deal with this. Instead of that, there's this urge, there's this compulsion to make sure we got in there before the Russians, and that we demonstrated to these commies that we had this weapon that they'll never get, and that we can use again if we so please.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
So difficult, for people to grasp all this, you know. I mean, and we've forgotten, first of all. The very idea that we're kind of giddy. You have people say, "Oh, the Russian stuff wouldn't work," or they might use tactical, or Medvedev, the guy who had run Russia, I guess, with Putin's tutelage, and now he's the head of their national security, talked about, actually, they put weapons in Belarus. He's talked about maybe using them. And the fact of the matter is, you know, if they get desperate, we've called them all war criminals. So if they think they're going to go to some Nuremberg and they're going to face the death penalty, that's not how you begin negotiations. You know, we had very dark view of Mao, but Nixon went there and made nice, you know, and so did Kissinger, to negotiate. Aren't you afraid? I mean, I don't want to just get into rhetoric here. I have never been this frightened, and I've covered this issue not from the inside viewpoint that you have, but I spent a lot of time, I actually spent hours talking to people in the Defense Department everywhere, quite a bit of time when I worked for the LA Times, wrote that book. I have never been as scared as now, because back then, you know, Ronald Reagan knew. He said, yes, we wouldn't do that, but those monsters have a different feeling about life and so forth. But no one defended. Even Edward Teller would not say it's, you know, hey, yeah, let's have a nuclear war. It was, you know, everybody understood that was the end of anything like civilization. Now we've lost that, haven't we? And we're talking on a day, remember Nagasaki, and you're absolutely correct. The movie, in that respect, a conscious decision was made not to show the devastation of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. No question about it. And, you know, that's a decision. I don't think it was done out of racism. I think it was done that a recognition that movie audiences are impervious to that. They've seen it. So, okay, it's a picture. And I think one theatrical device, when he showed white scientists suddenly having what the bomb does to their faces and imploding, you know, and so forth, I thought that was a device. But nonetheless, where are we now on this nuclear question? It's very much in play with Russia right now. We haven't talked about that CNN report. It seems as if the new technology and the training of the Ukrainians is not working. And I don't know what's going to happen. You have the idea that I've seen reference that maybe the Biden administration to hold on to power might do a whack the dog scenario or something. So let's talk about that. What is the danger of nuclear war now? What might be, how do you see the Biden administration? I was accused last time of interrupting too much and talking too much, which I'm always accused of. So please, Ray, just take it from there.
Well, Irish and Jewish from the Bronx do tend to talk a lot. Let me just have another sentence on Oppenheimer. The audience is left with the erroneous impression that thousands, hundreds of thousands of U.S. lives would have been lost in invading Japan had we not detonated these bombs. That is criminally wrong, okay? There's only one little thing in there that suggested Oppenheimer himself says, you know, now I know that wasn't necessary. Well, oh, yeah, it wasn't necessary. So why did they do it? Now, I don't accuse the movie makers of racism. I accuse Truman. I accuse Jimmy Burns, just like I accuse William Westmoreland, who pretty much said, yeah, the Oriental doesn't put on the same value on life. Life is cheaper than the Orient. I mean, hello. That's pure and simple racism, and a lot of it comes out of South Carolina, where Westmoreland was, as well as Jimmy Burns. Now, getting to the question of now, Robert, you're a lot older than I am. Three years.
I'm in pretty good shape, though. Right? Don't push me. If we were to meet there somewhere on the Grand Concourse or somewhere, you know, I wouldn't get out of your way. I think I can handle you. But go ahead.
You probably could. I'm 3 years younger than you. But what I would say is that I've spent six decades, following Soviet and now Russian policy, most of that time professionally, now since, well, last few decades, really just as intently. And I have never had so much fears that we are on the cusp of a nuclear catastrophe. Why? Because the people advising Joe Biden, and Joe Biden is compass mentis or not, I don't know, but the people advising him are calling the shots. They have a lot to lose if Ukraine goes. Chum. Now, I hate to tell you this, but Ukraine is going. Chum. Russia is winning. And whoever advised, probably the CIA director advised the president to say, Russia has already lost. Okay. Hello? So what happens to the CIA director? He gets promoted to be a cabinet officer, a really a stupid thing in and of itself. Anyhow, there's a degree of unreality here. Biden up in, he was in Maine campaigning, a lot of rhetoric. And then he met at a small home. Someone was there and reported. What does he say? Who can shape the whole world at this stage in life? Not the president, not me, but the president of the United States can. Who else but the president of the United States? I'm going to do it. Madeleine Albright was right. She talked about us being essential, exceptional, indispensable, even we're going to do it. Now, that's unreal. Do these guys tell him that? They must tell him that because they get promoted to the cabinet. Bill Burns himself, just a couple of weeks later, said Russia has already lost, and the defeat, the weakness of the Russian army has been laid bare for all to see. Well, that's 180 degrees away from the real situation. So just last night, CNN had an honest report. Ukrainians are losing. They're taking a real bashing. They're not going to win anytime soon. Maybe they can last until next year, but that even is doubtful. Whoa! Same CNN that was saying 2 weeks ago, this is going to be a great counteroffensive. Just watch this. General Herching, what do you think? Oh, we're going to win. General so-and-so, oh yeah, we'll take back Crimea. It's all BS. And the problem is they're going to have to try to figure out some way to rejigger the narrative here so the Americans will say, well, wait a second, I thought we were winning. I thought the Ukrainians were winning. They're not. And we'll have to decide, well, how do we handle this? Now, the media is so malleable that they probably won't have any trouble persuading Americans, well, this was all good. We tried. We said that we gave Ukraine 98% of what they needed, and I guess they just couldn't handle it. That's the way it's going to come down. Meanwhile, hundreds of Ukrainian young men and some old men like me are perishing every day that the U.S. and the Ukrainians and NATO don't say, well, look, let's stop this. Let's stop this carnage. Let's talk.
So I want to cut to the chase here on the moral question, because there will be people listening to this right now, and they will take the high moral ground. They will say that McGovern and that, you know, really dangerous guy Scheer, they don't care about the freedom of the Ukrainians. They don't care about their rights. They don't care about the moral question. And they just want to give up. And we should have a poll now that shows most Americans, or not by a big majority, but a majority, don't want to give more aids. We're now starting to see Ukraine as another one of those forever wars and so forth. But at the core of it is that the Biden administration, the Democrats, were able to establish in the mass media, their soft power world, that they represent virtue. This is, again, the old American exceptionalism. And that anyone else's nationalism is illegitimate and dangerous to the world if it conflicts with us. I think if we look back at our lives in this country, Ray McGovern, that's been the issue. It was the issue even in getting a peace agreement or getting out of the war with Japan and not dropping the bomb because, okay, let them have their emperor. No, they're war criminals. They have to be. It's happening now with Russia. There's no Russian side to this. The fact is, the area that they're now fortified and protecting might have, probably has, the evidence would have, showed that those people probably voted against the current government in Ukraine. Did not want this sharp break and so forth, speak mostly Russian, have a connection with Russia, certainly people in Crimea. There's no complexity. We're now pushing Russia because we want to get to China, and we're very angry with China. We don't have any respect for Chinese nationalism. We don't know that, you know, maybe they've had experience with us. No, we can provoke them with Taiwan. We can exacerbate that. So I want to ask you, as a person who lived deep within this military-industrial establishment, you have an insight that I certainly don't have. Because I've interviewed a lot of these people. They're smart. They probably got higher test scores than I did. They probably, can justify their expertise in terms of the languages they speak and so forth. How do they consistently get it so wrong? Why do they not know, for example, let's just take China. Why do they not know that Chinese nationalism isn't now what these communists in China are really talking about? This is nationalism. Why isn't this multipolar world acceptable to them? Why do they insist? And here we are on the day when we killed so many Japanese. We're the only ones. This is the greatest act, I think, of terrorism, if by that you mean using civilians to make a point, and their death, certainly what we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is the greatest act of terrorism. Why do they still have this arrogance that they got it right and that they represent human values for everybody in the world? You lived with these people. You broke bread with them. You talked to them. Why are we these oddballs now having this discussion? Why don't your colleagues that are on CNN, turned into journalists, why don't they see it? I mean, actually, that discussion today that I watched, you sent the tape, and the report, I forget his name, but he was very good in his 7 minutes, who's been covering the war. The attitude was, first of all, they talked about, well, we may have splits now, or maybe, you're not a journalist then. What they just assume, Anderson, you might want to talk about him a little bit, just assumes he represents the U.S. government, and that represents virtue. Why? How did they maintain this?
Well, I call Anderson Cooper, I call him Hans Christian Andersen Cooper, because he tells all the fairy tales that he's told to tell on CNN.
He's a smart guy. But you lived with these people. I'm trying to get a different, I could say things like that too, but I didn't go to the cafeteria with these people, the journalists as well as the people inside the CIA. But you did,
No. Bob, the big difference here is you didn't go to cafeteria with these people at City College, and there was no one at Fordham to go to the cafeteria with the high shoes, with the claim to exceptionalism that these guys had. Now, you know about Vietnam. You know a lot about Vietnam. You have interviewed these guys. It's the same best and brightest that knew what was best for our country, knew we could prevail over those.
David Halberstam, the great New York Times reporter, wrote that book, The Best and the Brightest.
So they didn't go to City College. They didn't go to Fordham. Where'd they go? You know where they went, with the ivy mantle walls and all that kind of stuff. Okay, it's the same brood of cat that's running our policy. Sullivan, Blinken, Nolan. Hello, it's just really, really, they have the reins of power, and they're telling Biden what to do. They have a sense of unreality that they can prevail. That was very clear at their first major foreign policy adventure, where the Chinese were kind enough to come to Anchorage in Alaska, and they were treated like the British imperialists treated the Chinese on the Yangtze River 2 centuries ago, okay? So what I'm saying here is that these guys are delusional, okay? That's dangerous.
Okay, Putin just said that.
Yeah. But the other thing is they have a personal stake in this. Personal stake, okay? Look at Joe Biden and Hunter Biden now. Look at Blinken, who was demonstrably responsible for rallying up 51 intelligence managers to say the Biden laptop bore all earmarks of a Russian disinformation operation. Lie, completely. Okay, so that, and you got, who's the other guy? Well, Sullivan. Sullivan was responsible for Russian hacking. A lie from day one. Now, curiously enough, Russian hacking was divulged to be a lie under testimony by the head of CrowdStrike, the cyber firm that was supposed to investigate this. He testified before Adam Schiff's committee, House Intelligence Committee, on the 5th of December, 2017, and said, there is no technical evidence that anyone hacked the Democratic National Committee. No one, not the Russians, not anyone else, no technical evidence. What happened to that transcript? Adam Schiff kept it secret for 2.5 years. Finally, somebody told Trump, hey, you're the president, you can get that released. And it was released. When was it released? May 10th, 2020. Okay, what is it? It's May 9th, 2023. That, I think, makes 3 years, okay? Why is it the Americans still believe there was Russian hacking that helped Trump win the election? Because the New York Times, the Washington Post, has kept that secret even since it was released to the public on May 10th, 2020. So Schiff did it for 2.5 years, the New York Times, everybody else, for 3 more years. And so you get people like Amanpour interviewing the Russian ambassador to London just a day or two ago. And she says, why did you interfere, mess up in our election 2016? And this Russian ambassador, we didn't. I knew you were going to say that. I knew. Let's go on to the other. So the media is the problem here. Now, the good news is today, or last night, actually, Anderson Cooper decided to tell the truth because he was allowed to. My experience with Anderson Cooper. Okay, here it is. May 4th, I think, 2006. I'm at a big think tank where Donald Rumsfeld is speaking in Atlanta, okay? I get up and I ask the first question, okay? I embarrass him by quoting himself back to himself about where he knew weapons of mass destruction were and how he knew that there were ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, and by inference, Saddam Hussein was in part responsible for 9/11. I nailed him on those two things. Now, as I'm walking, and it's on, look at Oberman's version of that when he was going straight, okay? Now, what my point is, I'm going out of the auditorium. Nobody's looking at me. It was a very wealthy, male, Southern, defense-oriented think tank, and I get a call. Hello, Mr. McGovern, Mr. Anderson Cooper. Oh, Anderson, how are you?
Yeah, well, I'm fine. You're causing quite a stir down here. We have you live on CNN and also on C-SPAN. Tell me, I just have to ask, I'd like to have my program tonight, but I want to have the question for you first.
Sure, Anderson.
Weren't you afraid? Now, I was pretty much, you know, I was in a state. So I said, well, that's a normal question. I said, no, Anderson, I had prepared for this. I knew that if I ever had a chance. Then I thought, wait a second.
Wait a second.
Anderson is the heir to a fortune. Anderson is the pretty boy on CNN. And I said, Anderson, look, it was a real high. Let me tell you, prepare good, real questions. Ask them from real people. You'll find it's a real high. And then he says, Well, Ms. McGovern, I'll have my people get in touch with your people for tonight.
I said, no, don't do that, Anderson.
Why not?
I don't have any people. No people. Just give me a call. I get on this program that night, 3 hours later. What does he lead off with?
Mr. McGovern, weren't you afraid?
As though everyone should be afraid. As Anderson Cooper has been afraid. So now he's not afraid to tell the truth. That's a good sign. Maybe Americans will come out.
Well, for people who didn't watch that CNN, why don't you summarize what happened? Because it was
Jim Sciutto, one of their big reporters, and Anderson interviewing him. And he, and then later comes on General Herting, who has been saying the Ukrainians, of course, are going to win. And then who else? Well, that was, you know, Herting and Schuto were the ones.
August 8th, last night, right?
Yeah, just last night. And people are kind enough to call my attention to these things. I had to watch CNN, okay? Well, it's really quite amazing. I had some of the transcript here. Yeah, here it is. Schuto's, Jim Schuto, you know, he's the big CNN military reporter. He says, look, the losses have been tremendous in Ukraine, and Western military sources and Western political sources just told us that this is really, really serious. They're not going to be able to do much. Then Lieutenant General Mark Herting doesn't disagree, and he says, now, this is why the defensive is failing, blah, 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 blah. The Russians, you know what the Russians did? They had from October to build these three rings of defense, anti-tank things and big holes and the rest of it, mines, my God, mines. 8 months they had to do that. And so it's really a formidable thing. Well, didn't somebody tell the Ukrainian army that this was what they're going to have to do? It's just really, to watch the U.S. urging the Ukrainians to spend their last Ukrainian on this completely unacceptable carnage and just die. It's just really very disappointing.
Well, I tried to interrupt you before on this, and not Domingo, but I do want to do it now because, yes, you explained this, that these are careerists and they go to Ivy League schools and so forth, and I'm not going to disagree with some of that. However, former General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, maybe with the urging of his, was he the head of the University of Pennsylvania, his brother?
Johns Hopkins.
Johns
Hopkins, I think.
Johns Hopkins. Anyway, he gave that incredible speech, very similar to the farewell address of another general term president, George Washington. No one ever refers to his farewell speech, but it warned us about the impostures of pretended patriotism. He actually was, George Washington warned us about an emerging military-industrial complex. But Eisenhower was really clear. And I wonder whether that's not more responsible than the careerism of Ivy League successful people, that a lot of money is being made for this. And this is NATO expansion also. All of these NATO governments now buy stuff from the Pentagon. You know, India was getting military stuff from Russia. That's going to go, even if they're not in NATO or don't ever be brought in. But NATO has now replaced the UN as the major thing, and it's a military alliance, and it's aimed at now China and Russia. And this military-industrial complex that you work for, maybe that's a good way to wrap this all up, because the more things change, the more they're the same, it seems to me. And the real winners of this whole thing are the people who benefit from an incredible increase in the military budget at a time when we thought we're going to have an era of peace. You work for the first president Bush, somebody I interviewed before he was president. He had been head of the CIA, he'd been our ambassador to China. And he thought you could cut the military by 30-40% right away. Donald Rumsfeld believed that when he went into be head of the Defense Department under the second Bush. Now, there's no such talk. There's talk, and here's a time when we're seeing the effect of global warming, climate change. Instead of talking about cutting back on wasteful destruction and building a military, we're demanding that once, you know, neutral countries, Scandinavian or even Germany, that said they wouldn't go down the road, we're demanding that they rearm, and they rearm with ordnance that is consistent with the U.S. Defense Department, right? And this is Eisenhower's nightmare become reality, and no one seems to even talk about it. This is the real winner here, is the military-industrial complex.
Well, we need to talk about it, Robert. And we do. When Eisenhower warned about the accretion of power of what he called the military-industrial complex, he said there was only one antidote for that, and that was a well-informed citizenry. We ain't got that, okay? We don't have a well-informed citizenry. If we did, our well-informed citizenry be talking about opportunity costs? You know, what does one F-35 that doesn't really fly real well in the dark or in bad weather, what does it cost? $200 million? What can we do with that $200 million in our school district or in our reaching out to people who are poor in one of those states? Okay, what can we do? That's an opportunity cost. Now, the mother of all opportunity costs is Ukraine. Ukraine has diverted all attention from global warming. It's actually stoked global warming. The U.S. Military is the biggest offender in some respects. And, you know, it's deprived any real chance, deprived all of us, from doing what is absolutely essential, absolutely necessary, that is working together, U.S., China, Russia, to combat this long-term problem. Now, you and I probably don't have to worry about so much, but yeah, we all have children. We have grandchildren, for God's sake. Don't these well-heeled people have grandchildren? Maybe they think they can stay inside their well-gated communities. They can't, okay? So there's lots to this. What's going to happen now is that the military-industrial complex, which I call the Mickey Mat, let me spell that out for you, all right? Military-industrial Congressional, intelligence, media, academia, think tank complex. They all play an essential role. But the reason I say media, as if in all caps, is because media is the linchpin. If you can't have the media cooperating on this, you're not able to do it. And who is it owned by? The rest of the Mickey Mat, okay? So that's one thing. Now, what's going to happen when Ukraine loses, okay? What's going to happen? Let's say we avoid nuclear war. Let's pray for that, okay? The previous president of Russia said, you guys in the West, you ought to pray that it doesn't come to nuclear war. Because if you steal parts of Russian territory, that's inevitable. That's going to happen. He said that. Did Putin say it? No. Medvedev is the bad cop. Putin is the more reserved cop, okay? But would they do it? Yes, they would do it, for God's sake. Do the people advising Biden know this? I don't know. That's what makes it so volatile. Last thing on this. How does Putin look at the people running our foreign policy and our military? He has said so. He was asked in October at this Valdai discussion club, Mr. President, the United States is taking on China now, as well as taking on Russia in Ukraine. What do you make of that? And Putin said, well, you know, initially I thought there was some subtle plan or subtle logic to this, but I no longer think so. I think they're crazy. Crazy is the word he used. It can only be explained, said Putin, by arrogance and a feeling of impunity, period, end quote. Now, I happen to agree with that, but it doesn't matter what I think. It does matter what Putin thinks.
What is the Russian word for crazy?
Crazy? Sumashechi. Here your is your mind, okay? Shed, which you're walking out. So you're walking out of your mind. Ooh, you're walking out of your mind. Sumashichi, okay? And, you know, they don't use those words blithely. As I say, you could agree with that, as I do. But what are the implications, for God's sake? And that's why after 60 decades, not 60 decades plus three, that you've been watching this situation, Robert. It's after 60 years, I'm more afraid that it will come to a nuclear exchange than ever before. And it won't be unless the Russians think they're losing. We told President Biden this on the 26th of January, 2023. We said, look, Mr. Mr. Biden, you can't have it both ways. You can't avoid World War III and inflict a significant defeat on Russia. You have to have one. If you have, if you're going to have them both, if Russia loses, I don't think Russia's going to lose. But even if there's only a 5% chance that they would put their backs would be put up against the wall to that degree, you know, I like to think that my grandchildren can live in a country that finally will address climate change and be able to survive, so this nice earth that we live on can be still livable.
But, you know, I've been promising myself to try to keep this under an hour, but then we're a minute or 2 seconds away from violating that. But at this point, and I looked at the comments, you know, when I've done things with you before, and people will say, so you... basically, Ray McGovern just made an argument that we must always give in to the Russians because they have nuclear weapons. And when we think about what kind of peace could come here, we're in an impasse because you have the U.S. and Ukrainian position, not an inch, right? They used to say that about NATO expansion, it would not expand. But now, no. Now they're even saying Crimea must be returned and no part of Ukraine. And they put that down and you have, you know, much of what used to be called the Western world supporting that. And Russia saying they would not accept that. What is the path of peace here?
Well, a good parallel, Robert, is the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think I've shared with you earlier on that I was a second lieutenant Army infantry at Fort Benning in early November 1962, and there were no weapons in the Army Infantry Training Center at Fort Benning in early October 1962. Where were they? They were at Key West. They were ready to go into Cuba. That was the Cuban Missile Crisis, okay? It was real. Do I think that Kennedy should have said, oh, okay, Nikita Khrushchev, this is a pretty good gamble you made. I'm not going to disturb these medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles that can reach Washington in 7 minutes and Omaha in 10 minutes. you could keep them. Just please don't use them. No, I don't think that. I think Kennedy did the right thing. Now, did Kennedy break the law? Yes. Kennedy broke the law. What was it? Well, he instituted a blockade, and he prevented the greater range ballistic missiles from getting to Cuba. Now, blockade, that's illegal, okay? He called it a quarantine, but that doesn't make it legal. What else did he do? That he assembled that force in Key West, that I might have been a part of that if I entered active duty a little earlier. And he threatened nuclear war. Now, you're not supposed to do that. UN Charter said you're not supposed to do that. Okay. Did he do it? Yes. Was he right in doing it? I believe he was right. So what am I saying? That he violated the law and that's okay? Yeah. Because when you feel an existential threat to you, which is what I believe Kennedy felt with these missiles within, you know, 7-10 minutes of key points in the United States, then if you can, you act forcefully. Now, what's the parallel? We have missile sites in Romania and Poland that Russia cannot be sure what's in those missile capsules, okay? They could be cruise missiles. That means 10 minutes to Moscow. They could be eventually hypersonic missiles, and that means five minutes to Moscow, okay? Do Americans know that? They don't know it. But it's the truth, okay? So here's Putin looking at these things. And, well, we don't know what. Hey, find out what's in those things. We can't find out what's in those things. But we know they come in capsules that accommodate cruise missiles and all the kinds of missiles. So it's a danger, okay? A danger to Moscow, a danger to our ICM fleet in the western part of Russia. So what does Putin do? Now, this is probably something, this is almost certainly something your audience doesn't know. He calls up, or that is, the Kremlin calls up the White House on the 30th of December, 2021, And Mr. Putin would like to talk to Mr. Bush. Now, wait a second. Our negotiators, as agreed,
I missed a scene here.
Okay. This is 2021, December 30th. The negotiations on satisfying Russian desires with respect to a new architecture in security architecture in Europe are to begin in Geneva in 9 days. That is in 9-10 January.
In 2021?
That's right. Well, 2021, December 30th, 2022, January 9-10. So we're right before the invasion, okay? Let me set the stage. Biden and Putin talked in mid-December.
Oh, because you had said Bush before. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Sometimes I say Bush when I mean Biden. Yeah. So Biden and Putin talked early in December. They said, okay, let's do negotiations. We'll do that real quick because the Russians wanted in Geneva. It'll be start on the 9th, 10th of Geneva. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes a phone call from the Kremlin where Mr. Putin wants to talk to Mr. Biden right away. And there's confusion, but to his credit, Biden says, okay, what's the readout? The readout is Mr. Biden said that the U.S. has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, period, end quote. Whoa, great rejoicing in Moscow on New Year's Eve. The next day, everyone's thinking, wow, this is get the Geneva negotiations off to a great start. What happens? They forgot about it. The negotiators were told, don't talk about this. Biden misspoke. So what happens? On the 12th of February now, January, February, Biden and Putin speak again. Read out. Mr. Biden said, we are not going to be able to talk about not putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. Mind you, they're already in Poland, they're already in Romania. He had said that he would not do it on the 30th of December. Now, what, 6 weeks later, he's saying, we're not even going to talk about that, okay? So what happens? That's the 12th, less than 2 weeks later, Putin marches in to Ukraine. Now, the important thing there is that there were indications starting in very mid-February, a big upsurge in artillery shelling and other things having to do with the Donbas regions of Donetsk and Lugansk. And it looked like the Ukrainians were going to go into the Donbas and do their best. Do their worst with the Russian-speaking citizens there. So you had this strategic threat. You had this immediate threat that was very, very confirmed now, okay? And then you had this general sense that, you know, if you don't move now, as Putin has said, it's going to be too late. You should have done it when they overthrew the government in 2014. It's now or never. One other key factor, Putin, in my view, would not have done it had he not had Xi Jinping's support. He had just gotten that on the 4th of February when he told Xi Jinping, in my view, look, we're going to have to do this. What do you think? And Xi Jinping says, you mean after the Olympics, the Winter Olympics are over, right? Oh, yeah, yeah. 20th of February, the Olympics are over. The 21st, Donetsk and Lugansk declare independence. 22nd, the USSR, Russia recognizes them and heeds their plea for help. The next day, the Duma approves the invasion and the Russians go in. So it's much more complicated than has been than the impression given in mass media. And the mass media has been drumming, has been, as you say, as I said, the fulcrum for the Mickey Mat, the military-industrial congressional intelligence media academia think tank complex, which has distorted Americans into believing that Putin is the devil incarnate and has never retracted all these things that were invented by the Democrats, starting with Hillary Clinton and Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken and all those guys that now have a personal stake in making sure that no one wins, like that fellow Trump. My God, they could end up in jail because the evidence is there. It's in black and white. They're very fearful, and so I'm fearful that with this personal stake in these things, what the hell are they going to do? If I'm fearful, I think that Mr. Putin is equally fearful, and that has a very labile, very volatile element in this whole situation, Robert.
So let me wrap this up on a broader philosophical point. Both of us came out of World War II. Even though I'm a little older, I was born in 1936. I guess you were born in 1940?
No, 1939. I was born a week before the war.
Yeah, but you sort of missed the Depression. And in fact, you benefited, I know, because both of us were up there in the Bronx. With the war came the jobs. And all of our families suddenly economically were better off. But American troops were not yet being sent to Europe. And then the war, hard for people to remember, but for the U.S., the war was quite brief. Not for the Russians, and obviously not for the people of Eastern Europe and Central Europe and so forth. But, you know, there had been a lively discussion in the United States about whether we should even be in the war. And opening up the second front, you know, because, all right, let the Russians and Germans fight it out and everything. Yeah. And then sitting up there in the Bronx, we were deprived of our bubble gum, maybe certain kind of stockings, you know, whatever. You know, we had victory gardens. And then we got into the war, and then you had, you know, memorials, Gold Star Mothers, and the real, of course, I know my half-brother actually was in the Army Air Force. He bombed our home area of Germany. I mean, we had relatives, you know, involved. And so then it was real, but it was a short period of time. And then there was the great victory. And with the great victory came the idea we would now live in peace, right? And one of the things, and that's where we're getting, maybe we'll conclude with Oppenheimer. There was real confusion, and this comes up in the movie, that these Reds were not all bad people. You know, like Oppenheimer, whether he was a Red or a sympathizer, he was organizing the workers in his lab that they should be in unions. Or, you know, he was hanging around with a lot of people who thought, you know, being a Red meant you supported civil rights or you believed in peace and so forth. There was at least an illusion. And certainly Henry Wallace, who had been vice president, was part of that. Mm. Then this man Truman comes in, and he, you know, they prevail upon Roosevelt to get rid of Wallace. Certainly was an advocate for cooperation with the Russians. And one of the issues in that movie is why did we create the bomb with that urgency once the Germans were defeated? And why did we use it? And why did we not share it with others? If this is a weapon that, you know, we should want to end war. Why do we want to? And there's real a certain amount of confusion in the literature. Truman said we have a new weapon we're going to use, and Stalin acted as if he wasn't interested. And yet we know that some of this had already been exchanged. That, you know, Fuchs and others had given some information, but the bomb was supposed to be the weapon to end wars, not to advance wars. So I'd like to take advantage of your knowledge in briefing presidents and end with this movie, because I think it's a great teaching moment. The movie is, you know, seen by a lot of people internationally. And what is the real lesson? Why did we have the Cold War? Why didn't we negotiate some understanding then? And what is your insight? And you've been familiar with a lot of the literature, the documents. Was this really, did we start the Cold War, the U.S.?
Robert, it has to do with power. We emerged from the war as the unilateral power in the world. The Russians had suffered 26 million plus people killed. We, on our continent, experienced nothing but Pearl Harbor. And the first policy planning document done by George Kennan said, look, we emerged from this war with 50% of the world's resources, but we only comprise 1/9 of the world's people. Therefore, our policy must clearly be designed to maintain this disproportionality. We can't be deceived by soft power concepts like civil rights or human rights. It is going to come to the exercise of hard power. George Kennan, until I learned that, he was one of my idols, okay? So emerge, here we are, Truman is making this decision. We just beat the Germans. Well, guess what? We didn't beat the Germans. It was the Russians that beat the Germans, okay? We helped a lot with Lend-Lease. I'll tell you one little vignette that just really blew my mind. I was in Russia about 7 years ago celebrating the meeting on the Elbe River there in Germany, where Russian forces and U.S. forces finally met at the end of the war, April 1945. I gave a little talk there, recited a poem, and then this general, about 6'3", comes up to me. He's 91 years old. Abramov is his name. And he looks at me and he says, Studebaker, Studebaker, Studebaker. And then he grabs his arms and gives me a great big hug. Okay. Now, that was the only English he knew. What was that all about? Well, I at least knew enough history to know that the Studebaker plant, which made good cars in those days, 30s, early 40s, was turned over completely in Indiana, building deuce and a half. Okay, that's army for 2.5-ton trucks. Where'd they go? They went through Iran into Russia. Abramov was an infantry commander. He used these things to pull artillery, to pull troops. It was a very versatile truck. It went in all kinds of crevices and devices and cliffs and stuff, okay? So he's saying, Studebaker, Studebaker. Now, what does that mean? That means that Americans don't realize, although John Kennedy himself reminded us in his famous speech at American University, that there's never been a war between the U.S. and Russia, a real war, okay? And there doesn't need to be. There really doesn't need to be, okay? The Russians paid the price in World War II. We came in late, as you indicated. We made a substantial contribution, but in my view, the Russians would have gone all the way to Portugal. It would probably take a year or two more, okay? So what am I saying here? I'm saying that on the Oppenheimer thing, I think people need to realize that once you let the genie out of the bottle, once you develop this kind of technology, you need to have some sober heads, maybe guys that went to City College or Fordham, deciding what to do with this technology. You remember that scene where he says, okay, they have the bombs loaded up in army trucks. We'll take it from here, says the army. And Oppenheimer says, we'll take it from here. Well, people have taken it from here. We have all kinds of nukes now, including these mini nukes. And we also have all kinds of technology that allows our government to snoop on everything we do. Everything we do. Was that allowed? Well, it was not allowed, but it was done. How do we know? Ed Snowden has chapter and verse on that. So technology is a big yums. We can talk here via technology, but unless you have people who are kind of well-trained and kind of think of a moral aspect to this thing, and just sort of respect for the Bill of Rights, like the Fourth Amendment, like the First Amendment, all of which have been endangered. And then you have a technology ruling the roost. Then you have explosions like the ones done on people that don't look like us. I admit, I emphasize that. I think that's big, okay? And I think most of the world realizes that. So when we talk about an isolated Russia, right? That's bunk. It's an isolated lily white West. That's what we have here, okay? The rest of the world, people of color. Even the Ukrainians are accusing the Russians of being Asians, foreign agents with not the same price on life, okay? So we've divided ourselves, the world, multipolar, okay, but it's really bipolar. The lily white West and the rest of the world, 80% of which are people of color. Now, the people of color are coming into their own now. It's all over for the existential or the essential or indispensable West. And maybe I'd finish with a little ditty from Rudyard Kipling, which points this up in a way that I can't verbally. He said this, he said, you know, it is not right for the Christian white to hustle the Asian brown. For the Christian riles and the Asian smiles, and he weareth the Christian down. At the end of the fight lies a tombstone white with the name of the late deceased, and the epitaph drear, a fool lies here who tried to hustle the East. I think we've been hustling East long enough. We're going to receive our comeuppance. It will come first in Ukraine, and it will come this fall. I hope the decision makers have some measure of moral strength to realize that, okay, we can't rule the world anymore. Let's not blow it up.
And finally, what would be the terms of a peace that would be acceptable? It seems that we now have created a situation where, and we've been there before and people have changed, but right now it's pretty much stated that there is no middle ground.
That's true. But, you know, this all happened last spring, March and April of 2022, and there was an agreement, a draft agreement, initialed by the Ukrainian side, which Mr. Putin held up before a meeting of African leaders just 2 weeks ago. I'm looking for that agreement, but I take it to be, well, we know there was an agreement. The Turks say so. So does a former Israeli prime minister. The agreement was scotched. The agreement was put on the rubbish heap, as the British would say. Why? Because the U.S. didn't want an agreement. They sent Boris Johnson there. Now, this is not the government making it. This is in the Ukrainian press, for God's sake. They say, look, if you make this agreement, you're not going to get any more support from us. So you make a choice, go with us, or this agreement, this is it. Now, that's what happened. It called for neutrality. They had a codicil. There were 18 paragraphs. There was an appendix which talked about where troop deployments would go, and the U.S. didn't want it. Why? Because the U.S. admittedly wants to weaken Russia. Our defense secretary has said publicly, we're going to move heaven and earth to defeat Russia. And the president, in his delusionary way, has said, we've already defeated Russia, already Russia has lost. So something's going to happen next several weeks. And with the election coming on, well, Putin himself has said in the past that he realizes that many foreign policy moves on the part of Washington are formed specifically to satisfy domestic political requirements. And so what that means, God knows. Putin doesn't know. Let's keep our seatbelts on and hope for the best.
Yeah. Okay. That's all the optimism you can muster. It's not very encouraging, but, you know, it's so weird. I never thought you and I would get to this point in our life where we wished Richard Nixon would appear, or Henry Kissinger, and straighten this all out, you know, because right now to even suggest There's a need for a middle ground. There's a need for some accommodation. There's a need for getting along. We got along. I mean, amazing that they could make this accommodation with Mao, and somehow Taiwan, could be just fudged. All right, and Taiwan has been quite prosperous and had a peaceful existence. Now Taiwan's economy is in trouble, and they have to be worried about the future. So I never thought I would end any interview with a wishing that Nixon might reappear along with Henry Kissinger. My goodness, people will
say. Henry Wallace, maybe, Robert. Henry Wallace would fit my scheme, what things would happen.
But nobody watching, listening to this will know. Oh, anyway, let me just say I want to thank you for doing this, and want to mention to people that they can listen to this on KCRW, on the NPR network, elsewhere. And we have video on YouTube elsewhere. We listed at the bottom. But I want to thank you for taking the time. And, my hat's off to, let me make it clear, a good Catholic, was it a Jesuit school, Fordham?
It was.
Yeah, a good Jesuit education. And, after all, I worked at Ramparts Magazine, which was a Catholic literary quarterly. We were very influenced by good Pope John. So I want to set the record straight. I think a lot of wisdom can come out of Fordham University. Yeah, God, here I praise Nixon and Fordham. Cool. That's gone pretty far for me. So that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. I want to thank particularly Laura Kondarajian. I always mangle her name, but I believe I've got it right now. Laura Kondarajian and Christopher Ho at KCRW, the NPR station in Santa Monica, for putting up these podcasts, hosting them. I want to thank Joshua Shear, our executive producer, for bringing us these excellent guests all the time. Diego Ramos for writing the introduction, and Max Jones for doing the video, and the JKW Foundation in memory of a terrifically independent writer Gene Stein for providing some funding to make these broadcasts possible. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.
Rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Ni le bien.